public were to, that Canada eventually would need to tap the tar sands, and that we had a pretty good chance of having a commercially viable way to do it, and that this project needed to go ahead in the interest of Canada. And that's what I said, and that's what I meant. It sounds a little altruistic, if you will, but it was the truth. Of course, we expected eventually to make some money out of it, but nobody thought it was a bonanza or that we'd get rich quick overnight. But a big undertaking that ought to be done. And Donald MacDonald was at that time manager of energy in Canada, and he and I had a number of very strong conversations on the subject. At one of which I particularly remember, he put to me the blunt question, now, why do we need this project with all the oil there is in the world and all the domestic crude, all the conventional crude we've got? And my answer to him was that Canada is going to need this potential resource someday. And now's the time to find out what it takes to do it. And after a great deal of negotiation, we finally worked out a scheme, and I will never forget, the long, long day in the middle of winter in January in Winnipeg, in the middle of the worst snowstorm I've ever seen in my life. We sat in a motel in Winnipeg and had representatives of the three companies involved, also of Shell, whom we were trying to get to come into the project but eventually were unable to persuade, the Ontario government as a consuming government, the Alberta government as a producing government, and the federal government. And in the course of that day, which culminated a lot of preliminary negotiations, we worked out a scheme whereby the three governments would come in for a half interest, equity interest, mind you, in the project. The companies would continue with their half on the same basis they had been on, a 30-30-10 split of the half. No, that's not right, because ARCO was out. It was going to be 30-30-10, and the governments would not go more than the 50%. And the net upshot of it was that Gulf Canada increased its take, its portion to 20%. And the others increased theirs proportionately, so the Gulf Canada took a larger percentage share of the private company's half than had previously. Forget the exact percentages, mm-hmm. but that was about the way I remember it. And so it became a joint industry government undertaking, absolutely unique to the best of my knowledge, either before or since, either in Canada or the United States. Unique in a number of respects. The three governments, two provincial governments and the federal government were involved. The three companies were involved. The governments were involved on an equity basis. They weren't just loaning money, but they were participating on a risk basis. I mean, if the thing went kaplooey, they lost their money the same as we did. And if it was a bonanza, they got some return on it as well. We insisted on a number of things. We did not ask for any special breaks of any kind, price-wise or tax-wise or otherwise. What we said was we want and must have unrestricted access to the world market with this product. We don't want any government, Ontario, provincial or federal, telling us that we have to limit our production to thus and so, and thereby not get the full economic advantage of it. We want equal treatment so far as royalties are concerned. We don't want a special royalty to apply to this, and we want your assistance in working out labor negotiations, which will let us do this project on a reasonable basis. And those were all the conditions that we asked for, and they were all granted. So on that basis, we went ahead. In addition, Gulf Canada, which this was a big undertaking for us. It involved an additional $100 million that we didn't have, and both the increased cost and the increased share, our share being increased, required us to find another $100 million that we hadn't budgeted for this project, and we had to borrow it from somewhere. So we made a deal with the Alberta government, who had oodles of money at the time from royalties from other things, and were really looking for places to put it. We took out a $100 million loan from them on a preferred redeemable basis. I forget what the financial term is, convertible, so that they had the option, if the thing went as it finally did, to convert some of their debt to equity. So they were in a position to, and did, take back some of Gulf's additional equity in the project, and they became a larger equity owner as a result of converting their debt. So on that basis, the project went ahead. Gulf Canada had a lot to do with the technical success of it, if I do say so, because we provided the man who ran the thing from a technical standpoint. There had been an Imperial guy before, but he pretty well played out. He took retirement. And our man, Brent Scott, H.B. Scott, went in and took over the project and ran it and did a superb job. The net upshot of it, Jim, was that was a classic textbook example of industry-government cooperation and intergovernment cooperation in the development of a project in the national good, which I take great pride in, frankly, and which I think is an example that I wish we were able to have followed somewhat in this country with respect to the development of alternates, fuel sources, shale and coal and other things. But it was a very, very interesting project to have been involved in, and I'm glad to have had a piece of the action. I remember one little vignette that touched me greatly. My friend Don McDonald, as he became my friend, he was a Minister of Energy, who at the time that we found ourselves in the position of being faced with higher crude oil prices from offshore crude, therefore having to raise product prices at a time of price controls, price ceilings and everything. When the minister was out of the country, even though I had checked with the minister's office and told him we were going to do this, when he got back into the country, he found that in his absence, Gulf Canada had taken the lead in taking on certain price increase, which was a necessity and completely justified, but which he felt was not justified at the time. It turned out we were able to completely satisfy him that we'd done the right thing. But you have a tendency to get carried away sometimes, and that in the House of Parliament, one night he got up and called Gulf Canada a poor, a bad, irresponsible corporate citizen. That's what Geraldine referred to at lunch. And to be named by name in the House of Parliament in Canada is, boy, that's a pretty serious thing. I mean, that's a slap in the face. So I was pretty upset about it. And went to see him the next day or so and got it all sorted out eventually, and later on we became good friends. I have a high regard for him. But what brings this to mind is that in the course of this long day in Winnipeg, when we were trying to work out the final details of this Syncrude arrangement, the key to it turned out to be Gulf Canada and our willingness to take on the additional share and somehow finance the additional burdens. And I made the offer to do what we did, and he sent me a little note privately, and I've unfolded it. He said, "Now that's what I call good corporate citizenship." I've still got that note in my scrapbook somewhere. It meant a great deal to me. Well, I've gone on too long about that, but it was a major undertaking, and we were glad to have had a part in it. I think it was a worthwhile venture.
1975, Dorsey reorganized the company into global units, except for Dow Canada, or except for Gulf Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Dow Canada, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. why not Canada?
There were two reasons. One was that Gulf Canada was only a partially owned affiliate. Gulf owned only 70%, more or less. And the other 30% was owned widely, mostly by Canadian individual shareholders. And under the laws of Canada or any country, you've got to respect the rights of the shareholders. So it was not just something that Dorsey or anybody in Gulf could do by decree. It had to go through an awful lot of rigmarole. And that was one reason. I guess there were three reasons. The second reason was that we were doing pretty well. And Dorsey recognized that. And the third reason was that we were already organized on the basic basis on which Dorsey's reorganization was based, which was basically to separate the upstream from the downstream and the chemicals as separate functional entities. You said global, and you're right. There were also regional companies, but this superseded the regional company set up, and it was a more of a functional set up division than regional. Although regional was still involved, there was a GORAM, which was Gulf Oil Refining and Marketing, which was responsible for all of Gulf's refining and marketing operations wherever. But they had a domestic division in Houston and a European division in London. And similarly, the production department, exploration production, they called it, and minerals and chemicals. So the idea was to separate functionally. Gulf Canada had already been separated functionally, either by design or happenstance or developments or circumstance, by virtue of the fact that our production operations were necessarily located in Calgary primarily, and the operations were all out there and were more or less separate and autonomous from the central office, the corporate office in Toronto. And the marketing operations, which were centered really in Ontario but also extended throughout the whole country, but their headquarters was Toronto. So already there had been that functional separation in our setup. And so there wasn't anywhere near the need to make that separation as there was in the corporation.
During this time that you were in Canada, who were you reporting to? If anyone.
Yes.
You had your own board?
Yeah, we had our own board. That was an interesting setup. Gulf Canada was an independent, autonomous, standalone Canadian corporation, of which Gulf Oil was the major shareholder, owning about 70%. And the board consisted of 12 people, and three of us, or two of us actually, were officers of the company. Clarence Shepherd, the chairman of the board, he served as chairman, and I was president and CEO. And the other 10 were well-regarded Canadian businessmen across the country, from Nova Scotia to Vancouver. And they were selected because of their stature, and the board had functioned over a period of some years in a very satisfactory way. It involved only one person that had any connection with Gulf Oil Corporation, except me, and I'd severed connection with Gulf Oil Corporation. I was a Gulf Canada employee, paid in Canadian dollars and everything, although I kept some benefits from Gulf Oil. But Beverly Matthews, a lawyer in Toronto, served on both the Gulf Canada board and had for many years. Whiteford brought him in. And Whiteford brought him into the Gulf Canada board when Whiteford moved to Pittsburgh. So there was that connection. But in each case, he operated when he was in Pittsburgh as a member of the Gulf Oil Board, and when he was in Toronto as a member of the Gulf Canada Board. And he wasn't a channel of communication in any shape, form, or fashion. So my real bosses were the Gulf Canada Board of Directors. But I was not born yesterday, and I knew that I also had to satisfy my colleagues in Pittsburgh, because after all, they were the major shareholders. So I had the, again, diplomatic challenge of not taking to the Gulf Canada board something that I didn't have reason to be pretty sure would be acceptable in Pittsburgh, nor taking to Pittsburgh something that I wasn't pretty sure would be eventually approved by the Gulf Canada board. So, and that sometimes presented a bit of a challenge, as you can appreciate, but it eventually worked out. But I had the two bosses, really, and I had to satisfy them both. As to a person, as to personalities, at the time, my direct reporting responsibility changed from time to time. For a while, it was Dorsey, then it was Grady Davis, who was an executive vice president. Later, it was Ed Walker, who was a senior vice president. I forget what the order was, but they more or less changed around depending on circumstances at the moment. But I felt completely free to go to anybody in Pittsburgh that I felt I needed to for advice, financial or legal or production or marketing or refining or whatever.
I just had a question in mind. What kind of relationship did you have with Dorsey during this time?
Very friendly. Bob Dorsey and I go way back as good friends in Port Arthur, personal friends. Families were good friends. His dad worked in the Port Arthur refinery, and I forget what capacity, not a real high-level capacity, but he was there. He was in high school ahead of me a couple of years, and he was a bit of a legend. He went to the University of Texas after I did, I believe, because he worked a while before he went to college, and I think I'd gone to MIT by the time he went to university. And then he came back, and we were associated as starting engineers. He was in the bullpen along with the rest of us. He handled a lot of Gulf's relations at the time with the Natchez Goodine complex, and he was responsible for keeping track of the feedstocks we sent them and the materials we got back, among other things. And over the years, we kept in close touch, and I enjoyed a very happy relationship with Bob. When I was in London, why, he and Del Brockett, who was then chairman, came over frequently to see us. Well, by frequently, I mean two or three times while we were there the 3 years. Spent some time together. And I have nothing but respect for the man as far as our relations are concerned. Now, some of the things that he got involved in later, questions of judgment, of course, I have to deplore that, but as far as our relations are concerned, they were fine.
Did you have any inkling of the trouble that was to come? Or when were you first aware of the trouble that was brewing in the Dorsey administration?
I had no prior knowledge of it, and what I knew about it entirely was what I read in the newspaper. There was very little internal communication that I was aware of as to what was going on. Naturally, I was disturbed, like everybody in the company was, by what we read in the newspaper and wondering what in the heck was going on. But as far as having any idea that it was as serious as it turned out to be, we didn't. And it was a big surprise and a big disappointment. I mean, there was a great deal of sense that development came about as it did. And I think some of it, unfortunately, has to go back to Mr. Whiteford, who, as I said, didn't always do what I regarded as what he should have done. And some of the things he did, some of the things he set in motion, some of the people he put in positions of responsibility, I think really led to the problems which Bob Dorsey somewhat inherited and had to carry the can for.
So you're saying that some of that was in place. How far back?
Well, back when Whiteford was in charge, and that would have been back in the 60s. It goes way back, some of it. Now, I don't misunderstand me, Bob. Of course, he had his share of the responsibility, and there's some things that he did that he shouldn't have done, and things he should have done that he didn't do. And this, some of the overseas shenanigans were obviously out of line. His big mistake, I think, though, Jim, frankly, was not keeping the board properly informed and not taking them into his confidence early on and getting the benefit of their advice and counsel and guidance. I think had he done that, the Gulf Board, a very astute bunch of people, a group of very astute people, rather, would have guided him to his advantage. But he didn't see fit to do that. It wasn't his style. I wouldn't say overboard, but I made a conscious effort to be sure that I brought the board into everything we undertook on a completely open basis. I was extremely forthcoming with the board about everything I was doing and planning to do and had done. And I think that was part of why I enjoyed a very happy relationship with the board throughout my tenure.
I guess the Mellons weren't aware of any of this either, were they, until it broke, or were they?
Well, they were aware to the extent that the board was aware, and when the board became aware. Now, remember that the Mellon influence had declined considerably. When I was a young engineer in the refining department, in the vice president engineering in the refining department job. For example, I had occasion on a few occasions to go before the board, make a presentation, make a sales pitch. And General Mellon was there, and he was very much there. He was a presence, so much so, and he sure did know what was going on. And he was such a presence that everybody kind of watched what General Mellon did. If he nodded his head, you were home free. If he shook his head, you might as well quit. I was told, given some very wonderful advice by Mr. David Proctor, who was then the nominal chairman. He was the chairman of the board, but it was a kind of a nominal position. He was had formerly been chief counsel. And he said, Jerry, it was before my first presentation to the board. He said, now, if you get in there, and the general nods his head up and down, he says, you better quit pretty soon because you've made a sale. And he says, if he shakes his head, you're in deep trouble. He says, as soon as he nods his head, and if I ask for questions or something, he says, for Pete's sake, shut up, you've made the sale. It was good advice. But the Mellons continued to be represented, of course, through Nick Pearson, and to some extent through Jim Warren, a member of the family, and to some extent through Jim Higgins as president of the Mellon Bank, chairman or CEO, whatever he was. And so their influence was there.
Mm-hmm.
But not anywhere near the degree that it had been before.
I was struck by the similarity, although for different reasons. Back up a moment. Is the Dow board more internal or external?
Gulf, you mean?
I mean the Gulf board. I want to relate it to what an incident of Dow.
It was a majority external. At the time I was there, there were 13 members of the board, of whom four were internal members. The rest were external.
Because Dow removed the chairman almost the same time, I think. This was 75.
Mm.
And I think it was virtually the same time for different reasons, but the board simply said that's it. He only got in there a few years. And, you know, these two incidents are interesting in the sense that doesn't happen very often.
It didn't then. It's happened more frequently lately, as you can doubtless notice.
Mm-hmm.
But it was almost unprecedented at the time. But I must say that, as far as I'm concerned, the Gulf Oil Board did their job, and they did it very well. They did it very responsibly, and it was a tough job, particularly with the family atmosphere of Gulf, which extended to the board. It was a hard thing to do. They just didn't want to do it, and understandably so. But they did it. They did what was necessary.
Would you mind if we break?